You got a friend in me.
You've got a friend in me.
Celebrate friendship and beyond during the first ever Pixar Fest with the all-new Pixar-themed fireworks spectacular and your favorite park parades. Celebrate from April 13th through September 3rd, only at Disneyland Resort. Visit Disneyland.com for details.
There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you.
You've got a friend in me.
Entertainment subject to change without notice.
From Paris to Portland, you've picked up the guidebooks. You've followed the advice. This is the Fromer Travel Show. Pauline Fromer, president of Fromer Media, and Jason Cochran, editor-in-chief of Fromers.com, with the most complete, the most up-to-date travel information available anywhere. The pages of the Fromer's guidebooks come alive right now, exclusively on 77 WABC.
And welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. I'm Pauline Fromer.
And I'm Jason Cochran.
And as always, we're going to be talking travel, but we're going to be doing it a little differently this week. We have a guest to start out the show. He is Brian Kevin. He is the latest author of Fromer's Maine Coast. And I'm talking to you in Central Maine, right, Brian?
Yeah, you've got me on the mid-coast right now, not too far from the saltwater.
Oh, well, I'm jealous. It's such a great time to be in Maine. Well, it's so lovely speaking to you. It's a wonderful book. It's one of our newest ones, just hit the newsstands. And one of the things that I really like what you did, Brian, is that you give people authentic experiences in Maine. You allow people to go off the tourist track, and you give them some ideas of how to do so that aren't necessarily obvious. Like you say that people should embed on Monhegan Island. What does that mean?
Oh, yeah. So Monhegan Island is about a two-hour ferry ride off the coast. It might be a little bit less than that. And it's an artist colony going back a ways. It's got a year-round population that's relatively small. It has beautiful sort of cliffs and trail network on the back, really small village near surrounding the ferry terminal. Great brewery and a couple of other cool things that have popped up out there, and a lot of little galleries. And I think the common routine is to take a day trip, you know, to go out on the boat. You get there in the morning. You have time to wander around, have a nice meal, and find your way back. But there are not too many folks that manage to stick around for 2-3 days. And as small of an island as it is, it seems a little bit counterintuitive, but you can explore it really deeply in that time. And it's just an example of the sort of place where it pays off to take your time a little bit and not be in such a rush.
And I guess if you do that, you get to see the island without other tourists, with that, because they probably come and go fairly late in the day and fairly early in the day.
Right. You will definitely get a sense of the way life ebbs and flows on any of Maine's inhabited islands, but particularly one that sees a fair amount of visitors. After the last ferry leaves for the day, things quiet down. There are a handful of places to stay on the island, and they're all fairly rustic. You know, the folks that live out there year-round, and then there are plenty of seasonal folks that come out there and live in the summer as well, you know, tend to be a friendly lot. You can rub shoulders with them down at Monhegan Brewery. You'll see them on the trails. You'll run into folks that are sitting around doing plein air painting, which is a pretty popular activity out there.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
You can just cover a lot more ground in, you know, 3 or 4 days than you can trying to rush back to catch the boat.
So where on the mainland do you catch the ferry, and how are prices when you're on the island? Because I know sometimes these little vacation-y islands can afford to – prices higher because they're harder to reach.
Yeah, that's a fair question. There are a couple of places to catch a ferry to Monhegan. You can get there from a village called New Harbor with an outfit called Hardy Boat Cruises. That is off of the Pemaquid Peninsula and sort of on the mid-coast. You can get there from Port Clyde, Maine, and you can also get there from Booth Bay. I don't know that one route is particularly advantageous over another. I take the New Harbor boat myself because that's the neighborhood that I live in. And it's not more dramatically expensive than you can expect to find on the mainland. I mean, you'll pay probably $15 an entree, let's say, for a nice dinner. It's nothing too dramatic, even though, yeah, if you live out there, You know, you have to deal with the complicated logistics.
Well, you kind of discuss that in the opening of the book. You talk about the fact that, yeah, certain parts of Maine are overpriced in the summer, but you got to remember, and this came as a shock to me. I think I read once, Maine has the longest coastline in the United States, mostly because it goes in and out and in and out and in and out of all those little coves.
Yeah, continental United States.
The continental.
Alaska still got us licked in that regard. And, you know, bear in mind, Maine is at the end of the supply chain for a fair amount of consumer goods, and so that adds a certain amount of cost.
But there still are places where you can go where you won't be inundated by tourists and still have an affordable vacation.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, you don't have to break the bank to spend time here. And one thing that this edition of the book does is, you know, as we're increasingly paying more and more attention to options like Airbnb or some of these online rental platforms, which is one way to save money, you know, steering away from some of the places that tend to see a little bit more tourist traffic can save you a few bucks. I mean, we're still talking about, for the most part, working villages up and down the coast where, you know, the folks who live here year-round, the standard of living is not incredibly high.
Right.
Real estate is. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there.
Mm. We're speaking with Brian Kevin, who's the most recent author of Frommer's Maine Coast. And Brian, the most popular, and I may be wrong, correct me if I am, but one of the most popular things to do on the Maine coast is to go to Acadia National Park.
Sure.
But you say, get off the pavement, that a lot of people do it wrong. What does that mean?
I mean, you can't do it wrong, of course. If you're enjoying yourself, then you're doing it right, right?
Right.
But, I mean, the selling point of Acadia National Park is that it has one of the most terrific trail networks for day hiking, perhaps the most terrific of any national park in the system. Now, this isn't Yellowstone. This isn't Glacier. These aren't the great western parks where you're going to be out for a four-day backpacking trip. But where day hiking is concerned, this genteel little island, it was the playground of the rich for much of its history before and to some extent after the park was established, has this sort of beautifully designed network of trails that wind up and down these low coastal mountains, you know, a couple thousand feet looking over the ocean. And it's sort of like, you can almost think of Acadia as like the world's coolest giant garden, you know? This isn't a wilderness park. It's manicured in a way. But if you're only driving the loop road, boy, are you missing out on everything it has to offer.
So lace on your hiking boots and take some of those day trails. And are some of them doable for people who may not be regular hikers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a big advocate for reminding people that hiking is essentially just walking. And it doesn't, you know, an able-bodied person certainly doesn't require a particular amount of expertise or gear. And it's easy to become intimidated when you're looking at the ground at a trail that goes up, up, up. But there are very few hikes on Acadia that are not accomplishable by someone. I'm patting my beer belly as I say this. You don't have to be in particularly Adonis-like shape to be able to make your way up and down these hills. And certainly there are options for every ability. There's also the carriage roads, which are not hiking trails in the sort of dirt path through the woods sense that you would envision, but this beautiful set of cobblestone pathways constructed in large part thanks to the largesse of the Rockefeller family, which has had a presence on the island for generations, that were made to accommodate horse-drawn carriages that are now exquisite for biking, fantastic for walking, maybe the best cross-country skiing in the country when the winter rolls around.
Wow.
But beautiful in the summer, too.
And that's another point that you made to me in the pre-interview, that the season for coastal Maine keeps expanding. People are going there not just in the summer anymore. They're discovering its charms almost throughout the year.
It's really fascinating as somebody who lives here, and I've been here just about 7 years. You talk to folks that have been here for a couple of few decades or a couple of few generations to get a sense of the way tourism season in Maine was once pretty explicitly Memorial Day through Labor Day. And if you showed up 2 weeks into September, you could expect to find, you know, relative ghost towns compared to a few weeks prior. And it's really not the case anymore. All up and down the coast and to some extent inland, things kick off, you know, as early as early May. and things, you know, restaurants, attractions, whole towns for that matter, that kind of, you know, were shut down in the better part of September, October last year, really stretch out all the way into Columbus Day. There's not much of a division anymore between the summertime tourists and the leaf peepers, which is terrific because those in-between seasons are some of the best times to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about leaf peepers. Are there certain places on the coast of Maine? You think of leaf peeping, and I always think of inland.
Yeah.
But are there places on the coast where it's really terrific?
You know, yes. Inland is probably where you're going to get some of the you know, panoramic, you know, sort of postcard shots, and that's in part because you have a little bit more topography there. But there are places around where I live here in the Camden Hills where you have these 1,200-foot peaks that kind of rise and fall. They're completely forested, not developed, they're protected, where you do get some terrific foliage and some terrific vantage points from which to view it. You can also head all the way down east, which is to say beyond Acadia National Park. Down east is what we up here refer to as like the far northeastern stretch of the coast. Comes from an old nautical term. It's downwind of Boston, and it's the easternmost point of the country.
Oh, that's
you start
cool.
heading down east, and not only do you have probably less spectacular foliage, but still pretty impressive than you see inland, you also have all the blueberry fields, which after they're harvested in the late summer turn this sort of like breathtaking crimson red color and creates a fall backdrop that is every bit as dramatic as a really gorgeous foliage scene.
And I would think it's also a great place for foliage because you do have that variety. You don't just have to be looking at the leaves. You can go, will the historic boats still be sailing at that time of year?
By the time fall rolls around, some of the big wind jammers, which is to say the tall masted ships, have called it quits. That tends to be a little bit more of a summer phenomenon.
Right.
But there are still smaller services that can get you out on the water. You can still, you know, find the occasional sort of lobster boat captain who's looking for a little
for an extra buck
on the weekend. Yeah, they can take you around, particularly as you head down east. Some of those opportunities are a little more abundant.
You know, Brian, we have to take a break, but we will be back with more with Brian Kevin, new author of Frommer's Maine Coast, after these messages.
Get a jump on vacation plans. The Frommer Travel Show. Pauline Frommer and Jason Cochran. 77 WABC.
Welcome back to the Frommer Travel Show. When we left, we were discussing the beautiful Maine coast. Don't we all wish we were there right now? With the author, the new author of Frommer's Maine Coast, Brian Kevin. You also work for Down East Magazine, correct?
Yeah, I'm the managing editor at Down East.
So one of the delights, I think, of going to a place like Maine, from where we are, we're sitting here in Manhattan, you know, taxis whizzing everywhere, is visiting the small towns. What are some of the most interesting small towns if people want to really get that other side of semi-urban life, call it.
That's the kind of town we have the most of. There's not too many of any other kind here. As you work your way up the coast, you're going to pass through, you know, a succession of these little places that are a couple thousand, you know, people at most, and that tend to, as we said before, ebb and flow with seasonal visitors and summer people. In the book, we make a point to call out York Village, which, among other things, is the oldest settlement in the state. Has fantastic architecture.
What kind of architecture?
Beachcombing. Oh, going colonial. So some sort of soaring homes that have like an old jail and an old sort of general store and sort of a historic village that's been sort of, I think, in part maintained and in part recreated over the years.
Right.
You keep working your way up the coast, you're going to find your way to Camden, where I live outside of, which is a harbor town. Kind of a classic Main Street and a great place to employ some of those windjammers we were talking about earlier. I'm really fond of Stonington, which is a little town at the very tip of an area called Deer Island. This is a working fishing harbor. It's has actually, I think, the richest lobster landings in the state, or in any case, one of the largest fleets.
Hmm.
And Stonington is, among other things, a really terrific place for kayaking, these this sort of archipelago, these kind of soaring granite, you know, classic Maine coast. It's a lot of pines, a lot of granite. Fantastic place to put a boat in the water. It's also a place where you catch a mail boat to go to a little tiny overlooked portion of Acadia National Park, which is called Isle of Ho. It's a whole separate island that's protected that you don't tend to hear much about. It's distinct from the rest of Mount Desert Island, where the main trunk of Acadia is. Stonington has a few great restaurants, and it's just a pretty gorgeous spot. All the way down east, I would say visit a town called Eastport. You actually can't get any farther east in the United States than Eastport. And it's this place that's kind of seen a bit of a resurgence over the course of the last decade or so, just a real funky little former fishing town that has attracted its fair share of artists and others sort of looking to the kind of people that go to the farthermost eastern point in the United States
right.
and down looking to get away. There's a great museum there. There's some fun places to eat and drink. There's terrific hiking in that neighborhood as well.
We're speaking with Brian Kevin, who's the newest author of Frommer's Maine Coast, which just hit the newsstands. And, Brian, you make a big point in talking not just about the small towns, but also about your, I think this is Portland the biggest city in the state? Is that correct?
Oh, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. About Portland and its resurgence, which really has manifested itself, it seems, in the belly. This has become a very good place to eat and drink. Why is that?
I think it is in part because it has attracted a lot of big city chefs from away, as we say here, but from urban centers in the east and elsewhere who were looking for a place where they could afford a restaurant of their own and afford a staff and things that they can't in a way in New York City or Boston, say. I think it's also because we have a tremendous food resources here between the seafood that I don't probably have to say much about and a really fantastic resurgence in local produce and local farming, which has been a thing here since the sort of back to the landers kind of colonized much of Maine, you know, a generation ago, but has maintained. So you can get, you know, local meat, food, veggies of any kind. I think that's attracted people here, and you can't walk around Portland these days without bumping into a new restaurant opening from some exquisite place. 20 or 30 years ago, Portland was a pretty gritty town, you know. Some people prefer it that way. But, you know, Portland was kind of a salty seaport, and it retains just enough of that to be a ton of fun, but it also has this sort of hip entrepreneurial vibe. It's certainly a young town. I think disparagingly people joke about it being Portland, L-Y-N, as like a spinoff of Brooklyn, but I don't think that's fair. It's a terrific place to hang out. It has more breweries per capita than any city in the country as of last check.
Wow.
And some really fantastic, like groundbreaking beers being brewed. It's a terrific place for a date. It's a terrific place to eat and drink your way across town.
Well, that's cool. So, and that makes a nice contrast to the rest of Maine, I think, you know.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, there are pockets of all of what I'm describing, that kind of hip entrepreneurial vibe elsewhere in Maine, but they tend to be fairly concentrated.
So I got to ask you before you go, how are the lobsters this year? I know that some years there's many, many more of them. I think last year they had an overabundance and prices per lobster dropped. Are we going to see that this summer?
It's too soon to say. As far as I know, people, they're bringing in hard shells now. If it's been dramatically terrific or dramatically lousy one way or the other, I haven't heard yet. I'll tell you, I just had my first lobster roll of the season this last weekend, and it was exquisite. The price was high, but it's still rather early in the season. That's, you know, going
to
mellow out. You know, and it fluctuates throughout the year, obviously. But there is never, if you're coming here for a vacation, regardless of the time of year, it is worth paying whatever the market price is for at least one shore dinner or at least lobster roll, because you just can't get that experience anyplace else.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And you give us some of the best places in your book. Once again, we have been talking with Brian Kevin, who is the newest author of Frommer's Maine Coast. And Brian, you did an exquisite job on the book. I'm so happy reading through it. I so want to go to Maine now. But I want you to take me to your favorite lobster shack when I come.
Oh, we'd so love to have you, and I would be happy to bring you over to McLoon's.
Good. All right. Well, thank you so much for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show. I have to give a shout out to our sponsor, Allianz Travel Insurance. As you know, there's nothing better than getting away when it's summer. It's vacation time. But you want to have the perfect vacation. You don't want to have anything to spoil it, and you want peace of mind. To get that, I would suggest an insurance policy like those offered by Allianz Travel Insurance. They offer car rental coverage for just $9 a day, which is much less than the car rental companies charge at the counter. They cover travel delays, lost or delayed luggage. If you get sick and you need expensive medical emergency treatment, they cover that. They cover medical evacuations and more. To learn about travel insurance from Allianz, visit Allianz. travelinsurance.com. That's Allianz, travelinsurance.com.
The most popular destinations for you and your family, right here. Pauline Fromer and Jason Cochran, the Fromer Travel Show, 77 WABC.
This week's program is brought to you by Allianz Travel Insurance. Protect your travel investments from unexpected problems with Allianz. Visit Allianz, travelinsurance.com. Jason, I don't know if you agree with this, but I think one of the best ways to get ready for travel is to read. And not just guidebooks, to read novels, to read history. Well, our next guest has taken that to a new level. She has a wonderful book out. It's called Novel Destinations, A Travel Guide to Literary Landmarks from Jane Austen's Bath to Ernest Hemingway's Key West. Her name is Shannon McKenna Schmidt, and her co-author is Joni Rendon. And welcome to the Fromer Travel Show.
Thank you so much.
So what was the inspiration for writing this book?
Well, the inspiration came because my co-author Joni and I were each planning a literary-themed trip around the same time. I was going to Louisa May Alcott's home in Concord, Massachusetts, and she was planning a trip to Dublin and planning all kinds of literary activities. And so the two of us were talking, and we just, you know, discovered we were both doing this at the same time, and we thought, hey, you know, if we love this, maybe other people do too. Mm-hmm. And the book really grew out of that.
And this is the second edition.
Yes.
So obviously you have found an audience.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what it's like to walk in the footsteps of your favorite authors, say in a place like the Lake Country.
I think it's wonderful. And Joni, a month after we met here in the U.S., she moved to London.
Oh.
So she actually wrote a lot of the European destinations, and she did our Lake Country, the Lake District sections. And so when I went to the Lake District a few years ago, I actually used Novel Destinations, you know, to help me with my trip. And the Lake District is great because it's a doubleheader. You get Beatrix Potter and William Wordsworth.
Right.
And it's really just, you know, I really think it just adds a whole nother level to travel. And, you know, one of the funny things is that we're a couple hundred years later than the first literary travelers who came in search of William Wordsworth.
Hmm.
There are actually three houses related to Wordsworth in the Lake District, the very famous Dove Cottage and his home after that, Rydal Mount. And when he got famous in, you know, the 1830s, travelers would come there, and they would even peer in the windows trying to get a glimpse of William Wordsworth.
Huh.
But he was gracious. If people were walking by, he would show them his garden and be very hospitable to them. And you can still do all of those same things.
Well, you can if you can get in. I have a daughter named Beatrix, and so we desperately wanted to see Beatrix Potter's house, but it was so inundated with Japanese tourists that we couldn't, because Japanese tourists learn English by reading Beatrix Potter, so they're huge fans, apparently.
Yeah, that place is small, and so they do show it by timed ticket.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember how far in advance I got tickets, but I'm pretty sure I got
them in advance. You got to do it in advance. We never got to see it.
Oh,
one of the things that surprises me about literary travel is so much is original. People assume that these people were often discovered 80 years after they died. But like you just pointed out with Wordsworth, they were often popular at the time that they were alive. So the things were preserved. What are some of the things that you have seen that just really make you feel like you're back in the day when they were still writing?
Well, one of my favorite places is the Chateau de Monte Cristo outside Paris. Mm. And it's Alexandre Dumas. It's a castle, but, it's a smallish castle.
So he wrote The Count of Monte Cristo.
Yes, he wrote The Count of Monte Cristo, named the castle after it. There are a few literary properties where they were conceived from the ground up by their author owners, and this is one of them. And it's exactly what I would expect from an adventure writer. It's an adventure when you go visit this place. You walk through a wooded path, through man-made caves, past a waterfall. There's a stone tower encircled by a moat that he had built for his office and humorously named Chateau d'If after the prison in The Count of Monte Cristo. And then finally you get to the castle. Where each room explores a different facet of Dumas' life. He had an affinity for gourmet cooking, and one of his last works that he did was a dictionary of cuisine. There's a Moorish room that he brought craftsmen from back. He visited Tunisia, brought craftsmen back with him to design this room in the Moorish style with carved stucco and colorful tiles. And to me, that is just emblematic of, somebody with, he had money, of course,
right,
and
right.
imagination and what he conceived.
Well, the book is so much fun because not only do you talk about these literary pilgrimages, but you also take people to literary festivals and to hotels where, like the Algonquin in New York, where the Round Table met. Although I got to say the redesign has kind of killed the historic feeling there, I think. But in terms of historic festivals or literary festivals, Bloomsday, we've got about a minute. Tell us what's so fun about that.
Well, Bloomsday is really fun because it's an unofficial literary holiday, and I'm not sure that there are any more of those, and that it's celebrated annually on June 16th. Dublin is the epicenter. It's all things related to James Joyce and Ulysses, following in the footsteps of Leopold Bloom, which is where the word Bloomsday comes from, the main character in the novel. But one of the great things is Bloomsday is celebrated around the world. So mm-hmm. if you live in New York or Philadelphia or other places, chances are there is something going on for Bloomsday. Maybe even a breakfast with the inner organs of beasts and fowl to dine on.
Well, it's a delightful book. Once again, if you are a reader and a traveler, this is a book you want to get. It's called Novel Destinations, a travel guide to literary landmarks from Jane Austen's Bath to Ernest Hemingway's Key West. Thank you so much, Shannon.
Thank you.
Thanks, Shannon.
The Frommer's Guidebooks come alive. Pauline Frommer and Jason Cochran. The Frommer Travel Show on 77 WABC.
Welcome back to the Frommer Travel Show. We have another Frommer author on tap. She is Elizabeth Kwok Heffern. She's written our new wonderful guide. It's called Frommer's Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. Welcome to the Travel Show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I guess the first question I want to ask, and I think I know the answer to it because I've been and was surprised, but what do you think, Elizabeth, is the biggest mistake that first-time travelers make when they're trying to conquer Yellowstone?
Well, I think probably it's trying to see too much. Yellowstone is an enormous park, and, it can take hours to get in between the major attractions. And I think a lot of people don't quite realize just how big of a landscape we're talking about. And you can certainly kind of stress yourself out if you overbook.
Yeah, I've always heard it compared in size to the state of Connecticut. Is that correct? Or can you give our listeners like an idea of how darn big it is?
I think the statistic is correct about Connecticut. It really is. If you want to go from the north entrance down to the south entrance, you really have to budget, about at least 3 hours to drive it, maybe more. You never know when a herd of bison is going to be crossing the road or something like that to delay you.
The best type of traffic jam.
I want to ask the flip side to that question, which is what section of Yellowstone National Park would you say is undervisited that you wish more people would go explore?
I think the northeast section is very much overlooked, and that might just be because there aren't any of the marquee attractions right there, and it's also kind of attached to the least used entrance, the northeast entrance. But, I have a friend who was a backcountry ranger in that area, and he always said that is the most beautiful backcountry in the whole park.
What makes it so beautiful?
You've got some really big peaks, some of the most dramatic peaks with the biggest vertical relief out there, and some big valleys. You've got the Lamar Valley, and then it kind of segues into another area with big rivers, beautiful creeks, wildflowers, lakes, and it's kind of the most traditional-looking alpine scenery in the whole park.
The Lamar Valley, that's one of the best places for spotting critters, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's especially well known for wolves. There's a wolf pack that's well established out there, and there's a network of volunteers who are out there pretty much every morning, every night, keeping tabs on them. So it's actually a pretty good chance to spot wolves if you head out there at dawn or dusk and you look for the people with the spotting scopes, because they'll usually let you look through them.
Wow.
I had a wonderful experience out there a few years ago with my family, where we were able to look through spotting scopes from about a mile away, and we saw two wolves hunting an elk for about an hour. Just watched them, try to reach the elk. He was standing in the middle of the Lamar River, and they couldn't quite get to him.
So you didn't see an elk kill then?
No, luckily we were hoping that wouldn't be something we witnessed.
Yeah, see, now that's a very unplanned thing at Yellowstone, but you could also set your watch by certain things there are to do at Yellowstone, and they're the most famous ones. For people who don't know, could you explain what I'm talking about?
I believe you're referring to the geysers.
Yes, I am.
Yes, Yellowstone has an enormous variety of different thermal features and a lot of geysers. I think six of them are predicted, so you can go to a visitor center and see exactly when it's going to be erupting or within, a margin of error, and then kind of head to those geysers and be guaranteed to see them go off.
Remember Old Faithful being the famous one, by the way. Yeah.
Right. I remember when I was there, I was standing in front of a place, and suddenly a geyser erupted, and everybody oohed and aahed, and the ranger said to me, the geyser gazers are going to be so jealous that you got to see this. Apparently, there are people who just go there and try and see every single geyser, and this one rarely erupts. So I had a notch on my geyser gazer belt.
Very lucky.
So this place has a very long history, too. I mean, people were going there before it was declared a national park. Is there anything you can see left over from those days of kind of rambunctious tourism before the federal government, came in? Is there anything left?
There are some spots. Up by the Mammoth area, there is Fort Yellowstone, which is kind of left over from the days when the Army served as park rangers. You can kind of take a walking tour of that area and see the buildings. You can't really go inside most of them. But one other really cool spot that not a lot of people know about is called the Heritage and Research Center, which is in Dardner, just right outside that north entrance. And every week in the summer, they do kind of behind-the-scenes tours where you can go in and get a peek at park archives and see some botanical specimens or skulls of elk or bear that have been collected and photos from the early days of tourism. And it's just like a really cool peek at the history of the park.
All right, some context.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Kwok Heffernan, who is the author of Fromer's Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. Now, there's a reason that we put both of these in the book. It's because, even though Yellowstone is so massive, it's fairly easy to get to Grand Teton. But why would you? How do the two parks differ?
They are actually quite different. Grand Teton, I think, is very beautiful and kind of a slap you in the face way. You get down there and the Teton peaks are rising out of the valley. They've got an enormous vertical relief, so they're just really tall and jagged and dramatic. Whereas Yellowstone is a little bit more, it takes a little bit longer to kind of discover Yellowstone. But Yellowstone kind of keeps unfolding for you. And I've been there, probably 7 or 8 times at least, and I love it more every time I go.
When I went to Tetons, I finally understood what the song Purple Mountains Majesty was about. Because, as you say, the mountains just rise out of the plains, and they're bright purple in certain light. They're just really stunning. But let's say you want to really go to see these places, and I think every American should go. It's one of the reasons it was one of the very first national parks. How much time ahead should you plan? Because I've heard, in the summertime, you just can't even get in the place. Is that true?
It can be very busy in the summer, especially the last couple of years. They've had some record-breaking attendance, and the National Park Service Centennial, I think, brought a lot of attention to a lot of parks.
Uh-huh.
So if you want to stay inside the parks, I'd say you really should try to plan about a year in advance, just because the lodges do book up quickly. But that said, the concessionaire, or one of the concessionaire employees, told me that there's rarely a morning in the parks where there's not an open room or two. They usually get snapped up quickly, but if you call the main reservations line and ask, you might be able to get lucky.
So where should you stay if you can't get in the parks? Is there much lodging outside these two giant places?
Yes, every gateway town has quite a few options, and some more than others. I mean, Jackson, Wyoming is kind of a huge destination, so there are lots of options there. A town like Gardner on the north side of Yellowstone, fewer options, but then again, fewer people. So those are also really good places to check out.
When we went to Yellowstone, we pitched a tent and camped. And I think I remember hearing from one of the rangers that something like a quarter of the tent sites are saved for people who just show up. Is that still true?
I don't know the exact statistics. There certainly are a lot of first-come, first-served sites. So actually, yes, I think that would be an excellent option, is to go to one of the park campgrounds and just, you know, if you get there early in the morning and kind of beeline it for a campground, your chances are pretty good of getting a site.
Yeah, we found that. We should have been better, planned it better. Although we did something that a lot of people I don't think know to do. We were there in the last 2 weeks of August when a lot of kids go back to school. And apparently that's when the park starts to slow down a bit, yet it's still peak weather season.
Yes, it's late summer. Actually, I think early fall are two of the really great times to go, because you do have fewer crowds. The weather's still pretty stable. And, you know, it's a great time to see wildlife, you know, especially wildlife like the elk and the bison are going to go into their rutting season, so they're just a lot easier to spot.
One of the things that surprised me was a place that I didn't even know existed until I started planning the trip to the park, which was the Grand Canyon of Yellowstone. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, that is, you know, one of several natural wonders at Yellowstone. Certainly one I would put on the top of my list to see. It's just this enormous chasm carved out by the Yellowstone River, and you get two huge waterfalls, the Upper Falls and the Lower Falls. I believe the Lower Falls are more than 300 feet tall, so they're quite dramatic. And you can hike along the edge on both sides to get some rimside views. But one of my favorite spots to go on the south rim of that canyon is it's called Uncle Tom's Trail.
Uh-huh.
It's not exactly a trail. It's more like a metal staircase that's kind of bolted to the side of the canyon wall, and you can descend and get this really kind of in-your-face view of the Lower Falls and climb back up. It's kind of thrilling.
So this is a very simple question, but might be hard to answer. What's your favorite part of either of these two parks? If you could just close your eyes and be back in the spot, which would it be?
Oh, gosh, yes.
See, easy question, hard to answer.
I had a really wonderful trip a few years back on Yellowstone Lake, where I had a kayaking trip, where we, you know, paddled out to one of the southern arms of the park, and we were just, it felt so far off the beaten track, and, you know, nobody else around for miles, and the night sky from that location was just unbelievable. I mean, I've never seen the Milky Way so distinct.
Sounds amazing. Well, to those who are tuning in late, we've been talking with Elizabeth Kwok Heffernan, who is the author of a wonderful new book, if we do say so ourselves. It's called Frommer's Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for appearing.
You.
Let me give a shout out to our sponsor, Allianz Travel Insurance. If Arlene misses that train and then misses the boat, if she had a policy from Allianz, she'd probably be okay. Allianz is there to cover you, to give you peace of mind. They can cover car rental insurance at just $9 a day, which is less than the car rental companies charge. They cover travel delays, lost or delayed luggage, and more. To learn more about Allianz Travel Insurance, visit Allianz travelinsurance.com. That's Allianz travelinsurance.com.
Pauline Frommer, Jason Cochran, The Frommer Travel Show, only here where New York comes to talk, 77 WABC.
Welcome back to The Travel Show. This week's program is brought to you by Allianz Travel Insurance. Protect your travel investments from unexpected problems with Allianz. Visit Allianz travelinsurance.com. We've been all around the world. We've been to literary destinations and to Maine and to Yellowstone and Grand Teton. And I should have gotten to one of my favorite places in Maine, which a lot of people don't think to visit, but it's really lovely. It's Andrew Wyeth's house. You may remember him. He's the artist who did Christina's World.
Oh, I love him. Oh. He's gorgeous stuff.
And, and you can see the actual hill she was sitting on when he painted that beautiful painting.
That's in Maine. Oh, I didn't. It looks like it's like Iowa or something.
No, he was a Maine guy, yeah. And you'll see a lot of the landscapes. If I remember correctly, Christina was sitting that way because she had a disability. She couldn't walk. And so she was, I don't know if she was stuck on the hill, but she was on the hill in that position looking up, and knowing that background, it gives it a whole different...
Totally different, yeah.
Meaning.
Who knew?
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, we would sail around the Maine coast. And I don't know what some of those towns are like now, but back then it was like going back to the 1930s.
Yeah.
There was a movie theater in Booth Bay Harbor that had to stop in the middle of the film to change reels. Hmm. So we had like a 10-minute break to go get food and then come back and finish the movie. It was a slice of time that I hope it hasn't changed too much with property values, but that coast of Maine, it is a part of America unlike any other in the modern day.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear you talk that you went to Maine, because I think of you as a Florida guy.
Yeah, no, at the time we lived in New England. And we had a boat, we moored at Nipswich, which is in Massachusetts, but very close to Maine. And we would bop it all around the islands up in there. But yeah, it was quite a way to travel.
I thought you were going to talk about Florida and literary spots
now,
there.
I've spent some time in Florida too, including in Key West, where Hemingway's house is. And it's great to visit, and especially for, like, I think as our guest said, for cat lovers, because there's about 50 or 60 cats living in this museum. His old house, and they all have six toes, one extra toe than the cat you might have at home. They're famous around there. They're given every indulgence that they could possibly want, and Hemingway hated cats. It was his wife who liked the cats.
Really?
But there they are, yeah.
That's funny. I was actually at Hemingway's grave site in Idaho, and like so many literary and artistic graves, it really reflects his life. People cover it with bottles of liquor. They leave it there as offerings, just as when you go to Paris and you see Jim Morrison's grave. It's covered with groovy sites. I think they've managed to keep graffiti off it in the last couple of years. But would that
Hemingway,
be
yeah.
of Morrison? But would that be one of your favorite literary pilgrimages, or do you have others?
You know, I it's hard to say. I mean, I often do that kind of thing, retrace the steps of writers or historical figures. But, you know, Hemingway's house was pretty formative for me, because we went to the Key West a lot in the 1970s. So I would say that's very near and dear to my heart, Hemingway's house.
Yeah, I would say, I'm trying to think what I was recently up in upstate New York. There's a cottage that Robert Louis Stevenson went to that he thought that the brisk air would help his tuberculosis. And you go there and you see a lock of his hair, and you actually see the ice skates, the very old-fashioned ice skates he used to get his daily constitutional out on the frozen lake.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a great way to get over tuberculosis.
He ended up in the
Marquesas in French Polynesia, ultimately, which sounds much more my speed.
But back then, they didn't know what was good for tuberculosis, and they would often take you to places that really were bad for it.
There's another cottage north of Albany where General Grant wrote his memoirs as he was dying, and they still have a bouquet of flowers given to him in that period, still in Grant's cottage. It's not open very often, but that's a place I'd really like to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's been a wonderful show for book lovers, for travel lovers. We thank you so much for listening, and to those who are traveling, may we wish you a hearty bon voyage.
Bon voyage.